This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
In my laboratory at UC Davis, we work with species in which adult individuals form a pair bond, a strong selective bond to another individual. These species include tiddy monkeys, prairie voles, and seahorses. They also happen to be the ones in which we see important roles for males in parenting of offspring. So the overarching goals for our lab are therefore to understand the neurobiology of pair bonding or love, as well as the neuroscience and consequences of parenting, and the positive and negative health consequences of social bonds. For instance, the effects of loss. And we'll talk more about luminance later. So why do we study love and loss in animal models? In the last few years, there's been a growing interest in the neurobiology of social connectedness and its reverse, the lack of social connectedness or the even stronger emotion that we experience as grief. There is substantial evidence from human research that social connection matters to your health, whether it's through social structure, being married or not married, having a smaller or larger network size, etc., or social functions, whether you have a sense of connection that results from actual or perceived inclusion, or the quality of your social bonds. Are they high quality or low quality? The lack of desired social contact, whether it's loneliness, social isolation, or grief, can have effects on our health as large as those of exercise, diet, or smoking. Of these categories, social isolation, just straight up lack of social contact, is by far the best studied in humans and animals. Lonely people, on the other hand, may have social contact, but it may be significantly less contact than they desire. Finally, grief is defined specifically as the response to loss of an attachment partner or other close person. And prolonged grief is now a diagnostic in the diagnostics and standards manual used by psychiatrists. So let's use cancer as an example. Loneliness increases the risk of cancer mortality by 9%, while social isolation or grief increase the risk by over 20%. Now, grief is a human emotion, and animals can't tell us if they're feeling grief. But what we can study is the response to loss of an attachment partner, which can cause significant distress in certain species. So I would argue that to study grief in animals, we need a model which, as an adult, forms these types of close relationships. So that excludes most normal laboratory models like mice, rats, etc. However, it does include tiddy monkeys, prairie voles, and seahorses. So I'm talking a lot about pair bonds. I should probably define a pair bond. It's a psychological construct, meaning that you can't see or measure a pair bond, but you can measure the behaviors that reflect a pair bond. You can also think of this as an attachment bond between two adults. So as far as the affective or emotional component of a pair bond, we follow the definitions originated by two famous developmental psychologists you may be familiar with, John Bowlby and Mary Ainsworth, and that there are three major qualities of an attachment: a selective preference for the partner, distress upon separation from the partner, and the ability of the partner to help buffer you against outside stressor. In particular, this last piece, the stress buffering, may help us connect the pair bond to long-term consequences on health. And we often measure at least one component of the pair bonds using this classic test pioneered by Sue Carter and Jesse Williams, known as a partner preference test, in which your subject animal chooses between interacting with their partner, a stranger, or spending time alone. So you'll hear this test come up again during the talk. So for the purposes of this talk, when I talk about pair bonds, I'm talking about what many humans would call a type of love. So let's start talking about the neurobiology of love. Formation of a pair bond requires the involvement of a number of different neural systems, including those that underlie the capacities for individual recognition, for reward, and for motor control. What I often tell my undergraduates is that if you want to form a pair bond, you have to like your mate, at least in the beginning, and you have to remember who they are. So we need both this preference and social memory. Each hormone and neurotransmitter in our bodies has a receptor that it has to bind to in order to have a physiological effect. So for some time, it's been thought that the key difference in a species which forms these pair bonds is the co-localization of oxytocin and vasopressin receptors, which are associated with social memory, with dopamine receptors, which are involved in motivation, and opioid pathways, which are involved in positive and negative feelings. A large part of our research is focused on the development of teeny monkeys as a non-human primate model for the neurobiology of pair bonding and trying to understand how all of these pathways interact as a system. Teeny monkeys are small American monkeys which form strong pair bonds. The males are fantastic fathers. In fact, they are the primary caregivers for the infants, and the infants are actually attached to the fathers, not the mothers. But these strong pair bonds make them a perfect species for us to work with. So one of the major methods that we use to study the neurobiology of pair bonding in teeny monkeys is PET scanning. This is a method by which we attach a chemical to radiation. When we inject it into our subject and use a PET scanner to visualize where it's taken up in the brain. One chemical that we've used frequently is glucose. Glucose is the only fuel that your brain uses. And therefore, you can see when we give radioactive glucose, then test the monkey with whatever stimulus we want, maybe their partner, maybe a stranger, etc., for 30 minutes. They can be awake during that stimulus period, and then we can anesthetize them, put them in the scanner, and look to see where the glucose has been taken up in the brain. And the cool thing is that the image in the scanner reflects the uptake from when they're awake and undergoing this behavioral stimulus. We also use pharmacology or manipulation of hormones. We often give these hormones intranasally, as you see here. And finally, we archive all brain tissue from teeny monkeys, which are euthanized for health reasons. So my own monkey research is not terminal. So when I show you brain slices like these, none of these monkeys were euthanized specifically for research. In pursuing these questions, we focused primarily, but not exclusively, on the hormone oxytocin, and you've already heard a lot about oxytocin today. But remember that I said that the key to being a pair bonding species was having dopamine receptors, opioid receptors, et cetera, in the same area as oxytocin receptors, the same brain areas. So in teeny monkeys, we map the oxytocin receptors. This is the oxytocin receptor column here in the middle, column B. And one area, the lateral septum, popped out as having both oxytocin and dopamine receptors integrated together. So what do we find? The first set of studies that we did was in male teeny monkeys, and we found, first of all, that when they form a pair bond, the glucose uptake in their whole brain goes up, but it goes up even higher in areas related to social memory and in areas that contain dopamine receptors, like the lateral septum. We said earlier that the lateral septum may be a key to pair bonding in teeny monkeys because it contains both dopamine receptors and oxytocin receptors. Now, there's currently no good way to measure oxytocin receptors using PET scanning in live monkeys. However, we can measure dopamine receptors this way. So one question we had was whether dopamine receptors change with pair bonding as they do in prairie voles, another socially monogamous species. When we examined this question in male teeny monkeys, we looked at a number of areas that contain dopamine receptors and found that the dopamine receptors increased in the lateral septum and none of the other areas post pair bonding. This, however, was in males. When we recently repeated the experiment in females, we also found a change in dopamine receptors, including in the lateral septum, but in the opposite direction. So one very important and I think fascinating thing is that even when a behavior looks very similar in males and females, sometimes what's happening in the brain is completely different. So we've also shown that if we block the dopamine receptors, we can almost eliminate mate guarding behavior, which is part of maintaining the pair bond in males. And we don't know yet whether that's also true for females and whether we'll see the same behavioral functions. These sex differences also extend to the effects of oxytocin and vasopressin. We've done a lot of manipulation of oxytocin and vasopressin. And for instance, we found that vasopressin enhances male preference for their partner, but reduces females' preference for their partner, and even results in females doing some pretty, you know, sexy lip smacking at the stranger male. Over time, we've mapped out our idea about the system that we think underlies pair bonding in TD monkeys. So in this diagram, each of the bigger rectangles is a brain area, and each of the smaller boxes are different kinds of receptors. The main idea here, you don't need to get bogged down in details, but the main idea is that stimuli from the partner are coming in from different senses. They're visual, they're somatosensory, et cetera. These produce neural information that gets integrated with oxytocin and dopamine in the lateral septum. And eventually this leads to attraction-related behavior. Now, we've spent a number of years trying to test each link in neurochemical-related detail in this model, but the point that I want to make is that complex behavior relies not on one brain area or one chemical, but on complicated neural systems like this. So, loss. I promised to talk about loss as well. We said grief is a natural response to the loss of a specific individual. And that's why pair bonding species make appropriate models to study grief. However, grief can sometimes be crippling or disabling, and thus negative for our overall health. TD monkeys show both behavioral and neuroendocrine changes in response to separation from their partner. Specifically, this starts out with elevations in locomotion and vocalization. They're searching for their partner. Cortisol, which is a hormone that's released during stress and is related to mobilization of resources, energetic resources, also goes up. We've previously characterized many of the neural and hormonal responses to separation in male TD monkeys. After 48 hours, the glucose uptake in the brain goes down in many areas. After 2 weeks, the whole brain glucose has gone down, so the brain is actually less active when separated from the mate. The TDs also show increases both in oxytocin and cerebrospinal fluid, as well as insulin. So there's lots of endocrine and hormonal changes that come along with separation. We've also talked about social buffering of stress, or the ability of your partner to reduce the effect of other stressors on an individual. The point that I'd like to make is that both of these are situations that in which your partner is regulating your internal state, whether it's kind of in a negative way with separation or a positive way with stress buffering. These are ways in which our partners affect us. So in our current project, we're looking at the interactions between oxytocin and the kappa opioid receptor, and how these interactions are involved in this ability of our partner to alter our internal state, either by separation or by social buffering. The kappa opioid receptor is the receptor that binds dynorphin, which is a chemical that your brain releases during stress. And there are kappa opioid receptors located on oxytocin neurons in certain areas of your brain, implying that these two neurochemicals are working together. So we can measure the kappa opioid receptor using PET scanning. These are TD monkey PET scans from the front and then also from the sides. And you can see here that in the control scans, our PET tracer is binding to the kappa opioid receptors because you have them throughout your brain. There's also a very obvious difference here in the middle when we use an antagonist to block the receptors. You can see that we don't have any binding then. And on the right is the scan when we use a drug to activate the receptors. Now, the really cool thing here is that you can indirectly measure dynorphin release using this method. So if something stressful happens and you release dynorphin, there'll be fewer available kappa opioid receptors for our radioactive chemical to bind to. So we'll see lower binding. So if you're protected from stress so that you feel better, you would release less dynorphin, and the radioactive chemical would show higher binding. So it's sort of the inverse of the internal release. So I'm going to just show you a quick sample of the data we're collecting on this exact topic, the effects of social buffering on the kappa opioid receptor. So in this study, there were 10 pairs of TD monkeys, 10 males and 10 females. Each animal and each pair underwent three conditions: a baseline condition, a stress condition in which they were handled, they received a blood draw, and then they sat alone for half an hour. and a stress buffered condition in which they received a blood draw, but then spent the half an hour with their pair mate. And we then scanned their brain to examine occupancy of the kappa opioid receptor. Now, for the moment, I'm just going to focus in on this one area of the brain and the one condition, the stress buffered condition, in an area that's associated with stress, the amygdala. So in here, we're measuring the kappa opioid binding potential on the y-axis. And you can see that on average, we're seeing higher binding potential in males than in females in the stress buffered condition. That means more of our radio tracer was able to bind in the males than in the females. And that suggests that the males release less dynorphin and that essentially their stress was being buffered better by their partner than the female's stress was being buffered. Their female's binding potential is lower, therefore they released more dynorphin. So basically, it seems like the females were better able to help their male partners buffer stress than vice versa. Probably not that surprising to some of you. Now, each one of these dots is an individual, so you can also see that there's individual variation in response, which might reflect something about the pair bond. Finally, I thought I'd briefly tell you about the newest project in my lab. I've always wanted to add a socially monogamous fish species to our studies of the neuroendocrinology of pair bonding. So we've been studying pair bonding in seahorses. Lined seahorses are known to be socially monogamous in the wild, but we wanted to study them in the same sorts of tests that have been used in mammalian pair bonding. So we set up a partner preference test on seahorses, a lot like the one that I talked about earlier used in prairie voles and tiddy monkeys. If you look closely here, you can see that there are grates with holes that are separating this tank into thirds. And then in the middle is a male subject. He's up against the grate across from his female partner. And the stranger female is kind of hiding up here in the corner. What we soon realized, though, in running these tests is that the behavior of the seahorses depends a lot on different conditions, like temperature of the water, which cohort they were in. So we found a general preference for the partner, but it was relatively small. However, having worked for many years with brown furry creatures, it didn't really occur to me at first that change in color, change in luminance, could be a method of social communication in these fish that we weren't initially latching onto. And we're hoping that those luminance changes are a more stable readout. So I think that color change is maybe not the most descriptive term, because what really happens is that these animals, in the course of seconds, can become brighter, somewhat shiny, and almost iridescent. So if you watch the seahorse on the left in this clip, you'll see that his belly becomes quite white, and we can measure these changes in brightness. Here's a still where you can see how bright this particular male has become. So we worked with Dr. Rafael Duarte, who's an expert in seahorse color vision, to help us quantify these changes. And I'll just show you a little bit of data. So we examined mutual interactions during partner preference tests between a focal seahorse and their partner or an opposite sex stranger. And so for each interaction, the maximum luminance was compared to the minimum luminance to calculate the percent change. In the female focal partner preference, so this is the white circles here, during focal subject partner mutual interactions, so this is the left, you can see here that the female subject is increasing her luminance slightly, while the male partner is really changing quite a lot, increasing by about 40%. During the interactions with the stranger, you can see that neither the female nor the strange male really were changing much as far as the luminance. Now, in the male focal partner preference, the black squares, you can see that the male subject is changing at about 20% increase. The female partner is changing slightly. And then you see a similar but less extreme pattern when the male interacts with the stranger. So he'll increase his luminance slightly for the stranger. She's not doing anything. The other thing that we saw is the female partners were mostly changing in luminance in response to their male partner changing first. And although I don't have time to talk about it today, we've also examined the changes in the brain that happen during pair bonding in seahorses. So, in summary, teeny monkeys, prairie voles, and seahorses all form pair bonds with unique pair-specific behaviors and unique experiences of love, loss, and luminous. How does this help us understand human origins? Well, understanding the neurobiological mechanisms for social bonds, both in species that are closely related to us, as well as those that are distantly related to us, can help us understand the evolutionary origin of experiences like love and loss. Also, humans are not unique in their experience of these emotions. Understanding that may promote our social connectedness, not just to each other, but to the rest of the natural world. Finally, I'd like to very gratefully acknowledge the people who actually do all the work in my lab, as well as the agencies that have funded it.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.